This is Pete Fornatel.
And Pete, you've been on the air in New York radio for years, is that right?
Wow. You know, though it's the blink of an eye, the answer to that is 40 plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I started here at WFUV when I was a student at Fordham University in the 60s. So to come back here is really one of those full circle deals that I'm really quite proud of. You know, I say that I've always been very honored to be a part of FUV's past, but now I'm a part of their future as well, and that feels good.
That's fun. And you were on the air there in 1967, is that right?
That's correct. You know, I was one of those people who came to college radio in like 1964, right simultaneously with the explosion of the Beatles and the British invasion. There wasn't much rock and roll on the air here then. There was just one rhythm and blues show called the Time Capsule Show. And I suggested to the management a program that treated rock and roll with respect. And first they rolled their eyes. But, you know, this was that time in our musical history when rock made the leap from, three-chord Stone Age-like music to something that was really incredible. I guess it took the Beatles to point that out to the world. But that was it, you know. I think a lot of people who got to their college radio stations, you know, indelibly marked by Elvis and the Beatles, just started expressing that through the airwaves of college radio stations. You know, they say there's three stories about the birth of rock and roll on FM. One of them was in San Francisco with the late Tom Donahue. The other was in New York at WOR-FM. But the real roots of it, college radio, all of those people like myself who started their careers treating this music seriously. The management went for the idea, and I started a two-hour program here in November of 1964 called Campus Caravan. And the idea was to play album cuts and to treat the music seriously, interview the artists making the music. Fordham had a very aggressive concert program at the time, and so, you know, Simon and Garfunkel passed through here, and the Animals, and the Mamas and Papas, and the Supremes. And it was just an extraordinarily exciting and incredible time to be getting into radio and into music.
What do you remember about Sgt. Pepper coming into the radio station in 1967?
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was responsible for a sea change in rock and roll and a sea change in radio, specifically FM. You have to remember that the Beatles had stopped touring in 66 and pretty much announced that they would continue as a studio band. Now, we hadn't heard anything new from them. Let's see, I guess Revolver was in 66, and, you know, the albums in England always had more tracks on them than in America, so Capitol every once in a while put together one of those mishmash albums like Yesterday and Today. That one had the controversy about the original album cover art, which was, you know, the Beatles in butcher coats with...
Yeah, but you're right. Revolver came out in August of 66, and then nothing was heard from the Beatles except for the Penny Lane Strawberry Fields single in
right.
like January of 67. So
right.
You were saying it was a long time.
Those of us who were tracking the Beatles, because they had such a profound effect on our lives at that point, you know, were always looking for what's going to be next, what's going to be next. And we heard towards the end of the year 1966 that they were going into the Abbey Road studios to record some new material. Of course, the first taste of that was the single Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever on the other side. And it was accompanied by a video that the group did, in which this was the first clue, I think, that we got that they were no longer the lovable mop tops. This was sideburns and mustaches and granny glasses and a very different looking Beatles in that video. Of course, by January or February, the winter of 1967, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields were both big hit singles. And then we started hearing about this next album that was coming in the summer. I think June 1st was the actual release date of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And I can't tell you the anticipation, how our appetites were whet by what we were hearing and what we were hoping this next thing from the Beatles to be. Somewhere around the end of May, the commercial FM station in New York, which was WOR-FM, started playing A Day in the Life. And, you know, that song has been a part of our lives for 40 years now, but try to think what it was like hearing that for the first time. It was a mind blower, no question about it. And, you know, we found out many more details later on, but the fact that it was one of those compositions where John was obviously the prime architect, but Paul had the piece of another song that got put into the middle of it, and it was this very different sounding sound collage. Because I think what the group did after that last tour was they decided that they were going to use the studio as kind of a fifth member, as kind of a super producer, super sound, super instrument, let's call it that. And that is why many of the things on Sgt. Pepper in 1967 couldn't be reproduced on stage back then. They were only meant to be heard in that studio recorded context. Of course, technology has caught up with things today, and there's a group called the Fab Four who actually does play the Fab Faux. I'm sorry, that was a Freudian or terrible mistake. Fab Faux, F-A-U-X.
Right, I've heard them. Yeah, it's Jimmy, got Will Lee in there.
You got it. Will Lee from the Letterman Band, Jimmy Vivino from the Conan O'Brien Band. These guys, they have the greatest day jobs in the world. They're not doing this to trivialize the Beatles. They're doing it because they respect and love this music and want to carry it on and want audiences to see what some of the stuff that we never saw the Beatles perform live could be like. And it's a fabulous show. Don't miss it if you get the opportunity to see it. But again, back then, this stuff really couldn't be recreated live.
Well, it also strikes me, too, and maybe you could talk about this, because one focus of this story is sort of the AM versus FM dissemination of the album, that that FM was, I'm guessing, probably much more able to deliver the complexity of this recording in its full flower.
Absolutely. AM radio was still caught up in the play a hit, play a commercial, play a hit, play a commercial, play a hit, play a commercial. On FM, at that time, we had established this notion of sets of music that took the audience on a trip, pardon the expression, on a musical journey. You know, you played five songs in a row, and one led to two, led to three, led to four, led to five, and at the end of the fifth, your hope was that the audience was saying, wow, I get it, I get it. And it was synergy. Synergy is, one and one don't equal two. One and one equal three or four or five. You know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that was the game that FM was playing with this tremendous reservoir of rock and roll music in the 60s that was all coming up at the same time, led by the Beatles, but also on the American side, the Beach Boys. The Pet Sounds album had come out in 66, and Paul McCartney says to this day that it was the primary inspiration for Sgt. Pepper. He remembers hearing it and saying, what the hell are we going to do now? And of course, what they did was Sgt. Pepper. The notion of a concept album, the fact that you could play all of side one, they were not separated. The tracks on the album were not separated. One led into the other, led into the other, led into the other, right down to that 40-second chord that ends the album. There was no single released from Sgt. Pepper. You know, the Beatles at that point had become, you know, the 800-pound gorilla. They could do anything that they wanted. Capitol was no longer doing that thing of releasing only 12 of the 14 tracks. I think it started with Pepper, that everything after that, as the Beatles recorded it, that is how it was released both in the UK and in the United States. But the brilliant tactic or the brilliant strategy of Sgt. Pepper was that there was not a single released from that album. It was meant from day one to be heard as an entity, as a show, as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, this identity adopted by the Beatles to get away from the imagery of the Mop Tops and the imagery of Beatlemania. And it was taken, you know, it was considered very seriously. It was analyzed very seriously. And I really think it changed the face of music from that point going forward.
And then musically, just to make the obvious point, but FM was able to deliver on that intent, whereas AM was probably struggling with it. I mean, I do know the WABC, because I've looked at those old charts, they were playing album cuts, and it was one of the rare occasions where they actually did play album cuts when they were playing some of the Pepper stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it strikes me, too, that they didn't stay on the album very long, and they weren't able to, you know, run these track-to-track-to-track sequences or anything else that you all were doing.
Yeah, that was the great divide, you know. I mean, FM had been the poor bastard stepchild for so long, you know, just a backup medium. AM was where the money was. AM was where the advertisers were. It was really interesting, you know, because, let's see, I got to WNEW-FM in 1969, and AM was still, you know, ABC was still a powerhouse. The top 40 was still a very potent force in this country, but FM just kept growing and growing and growing. And I remember the point where parity was achieved with AM in terms of audience numbers and revenue numbers. And I think a lot of that is attributable to the way in which serious rock music was appreciated and attended to by FM, as opposed to the, you know, the top 40 blather on AM. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Pete, you were broadcasting on FM as a college student at that time.
Yes.
But you also must have been listening to available FM too, and you mentioned WOR.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, not necessarily specifically about listening to that station, but can you paint a picture of how FM was being used on the listener's end? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like what environments, like what did it look like when people were kind of discovering FM? Because it wasn't in the cars, you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Gee, I didn't have an FM radio in a car until 1969, a Volkswagen Bug, and I got my first FM radio in it. No, you know...
So in 1967, what did it look like?
67, it was a time when, you know, there was a great divide in the country, no question about it. A lot of it centered around the Vietnam War, but you'd have to put civil rights movement in there. You'd have to put women's liberation in there. You'd have to put the different attitude about substance use in there. And I think that what happened was the big guys missed it entirely. It went right over their heads. By that, I mean network television and AM top 40 radio. That was viewed as corny and insincere and plastic. I say the word plastic because that was the key line in the movie The Graduate, which has resonance for so many reasons, one of which it was saying there is a great divide between adults and youth in this country. And it's summed up in that scene when the guy at the party goes up to Dustin Hoffman as Benjamin Braddock and says, "I've got one word for you, plastic." It couldn't have been a more vivid image of how it wasn't a generation gap. It was a generation chasm. You know, you could define it and describe it in so many ways, even the slogans of the day, you know. America, love it or leave it. Hell no, we won't go. You know, the peace sign, the middle finger. It's amazing now when you can look at it with some hindsight how it all sort of seems to break down along generational lines. Now,
yeah.
I'm sorry, the kids who abandoned network television and the flying nun and whatever crap was being thrown at them on the commercial networks back then, and the choices were a lot fewer than they are today, as I'm sure you realize. Where did they turn to? They did something extraordinary. You know, radio, since the arrival of television, you know, everybody thought initially radio would die and go away. Well, no, it just redefined itself. It redefined itself, and it went, because of its portability, it went into every room of the house instead of being the provider of primetime entertainment. And it filled, you know, all of the hours of the day. The morning drive and afternoon drive were the traditional prime times of radio. But FM broke that. In FM, the primetime show was the guy on from 7 until midnight. In New York, it was a fellow named Roscoe who, you know, it wasn't listening to radio. It was a religious experience. I know that sounds like hyperbole, but it really was, you know. And you could feel that these people were talking about and playing music that addressed the concerns that you had about life, about living in America, about the war, about race, about drugs. And it's that thing that live media can do. You're sitting alone in your room, your parents are hassling you about your long hair, but you're listening to this guy on the radio who's saying that this is where it's at. You know, this is, you know, the church of what's happening now.
Right.
It was.
And playing Sergeant Pepper and giving it a serious turn.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, as I said, the album was released on June 1st. We had a little preview of it from the commercial FM station in town. I had a deal with a local record store here up the street from the university. Where, you know, they would provide me with the latest releases for a mention at the end of the show, merely a mention. And on June 1st, 1967, I walked into that record store, got my copy of Sgt. Pepper, brought it home. Now, I was a senior here then. It was senior week. I was graduating 10 days later, June 10th. I didn't participate in any senior week activities. It all seemed so frivolous and meaningless. And I remember sitting in my room playing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band over and over and over again until I had absorbed every nuance of every track from the first note to the last. And I knew, you know, the other good thing about it is even though you're alone, you know there is a community of like-minded people tuning in to the same content. And in those people, you found some unity. In those people, you found some community, some sense of you weren't the only one thinking these things or feeling this way. You know, they called it underground radio, but the fact is FM was a very visible tree in the media forest. And the fact that you could, it was affirmation of the things that you liked and cared about and thought were important in your own life, in the life of your country, and in the life of your world. Now, again, you make statements like that and people think that it's hyperbole. But my favorite quote about Sgt. Pepper, do you know the writer Langdon Winner?
Right. I know what you're about to say.
Do you know that quote?
I do.
I've lived by it for 40 years. It still resonates as much for me today as it did in 1967 or 8, whenever he wrote it. You can use this or not as you choose, but the closest Western civilization has come to unity since the Congress of Vienna in 1815 was the week the Sgt. Pepper album was released. In every city in Europe and America, the stereo systems and radios played the title song and everyone listened. At the time, I happened to be driving across country on Interstate 80. In each city where I stopped, the melodies wafted in from some far-off transistor radio or portable hi-fi. It was the most amazing thing I've ever heard. For a brief while, the irreparably fragmented consciousness of the West was reunified, at least in the minds of the young. Every person listened to the record, pondered it, and discussed it with friends. While it is no doubt true that I have little in common with the gas station attendant in Cheyenne, Wyoming, we were able to come together to talk about the meaning of a day in the life during those few moments in which the oil in my VW was being changed. That captures it for me. That grabs on to the importance, the role of music to that time and to that generation. I don't feel anything like that today and haven't for, you know, a long, long time.
Yeah. So finally, on this topic then, you talked about taking the record home, listening to it. I presume that was on your own. Are there any specific memories about when you started tracking Pepper, you know, as part of your radio show and how people were either reacting to it or connecting with it as listeners?
I can't remember what date June 1st was in 1967.
What day of the week, you mean?
Yeah, what day of the week. Because my show then as now was on Saturdays. And I can tell you that I walked in that next Saturday afternoon and played it from first note to last, as I said earlier. And you know, if there was any notion that the Beatles were going away or not going to be as potent as they were when they were touring, my God, that was just wiped out, because you were wiped out listening to it. It was with such great pleasure that you know, we came to know all of the music and all of the songs on that album. And, you know, as much as the movies had done to make the Beatles palatable for an older audience, Sgt. Pepper did the same. Life magazine printed the lyrics to She's Leaving Home. And, you know, even those parents who couldn't deal with rock and roll could, you know, read the lyrics and see that Paul was talking about something that was probably going on in their own homes with their own children.
Right, yeah.
Another example of that, let's see, another example of that is, I think, September or October, the Beatles were on the cover of Time magazine, and it was specifically for the reason that of the impact that Sgt. Pepper had had. Right. So it was really like, you know, you finally got the sense that, you know, people who were laughing at rock and roll or ignoring it or dismissing it could no longer do that, you know. In April of 67, Leonard Bernstein did a special on CBS Television Network called Inside Pop, in which he put his stamp of approval on the better rock and roll music that he was hearing. And at the top of his list, were the Beatles, Brian Wilson, and Simon and Garfunkel. And if you think about it, those three had the best concept albums of that era. Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles, and Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel.